the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard up in the city of Shasta Lake. And they've got everything you need when it comes to John Deere. Go up and see them. They're also the new Ego dealer. They have a full line of residential and commercial Ego products in stock. They've got the zero-turn Ego electric mowers, electric riders. They've got all the handheld stuff. So go up and see them. They've got good pricing and good inventory right now. Or you can give them a call. Their phone number is area code 530-226-9226. Or you can go to the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There you go.
How do you spell that?
That's P-A-P-E.
Right on.
Or Peppy.
The old Pape Machinery up on Twin View. So we have Nathan on there. Got Nathan. Hold on. We don't have my computer, though, so I can't tell you about Nathan.
Now I think without your computer?
That's pretty much it, too. Oh, my gosh. Here we go. Nathan and his family raise registered feeder cats in central Montana. How fun is that? Home on the Range. Yeah. I'm probably going to have to play that today. He is a senior research associate and policy analyst specializing in federal and local government administrative procedures. And I have to tell you, if you live in rural America and you're not an expert on those things, you get to go to a lot of meetings and hope there's somebody like Nathan at your meeting. He specializes in land and natural resource policymaking, local government relations, and program management. He's also an accomplished musician and a self-taught theologian with a love for the classics. Nathan has worked with local governments to identify and challenge attacks on small farm and ranch operations that are facing increased pressure and regulation by forces and groups outside of Montana and many times outside the U.S. So Nathan Deshmaker he gave us a couple articles for today. One is called Climate Control Policies Will Fail the Farm. And the other one is CO2 Should Be Celebrated, Not Captured, which is kind of funny. Both of those are files you can download. They're on the page for today, which is February 18th, 2024. And we will be having a non-dramatic show today, just like a little side announcement there. And if you missed the drama of last week with our guest Aaron Friday, where we discussed the California initiative to give parents back their rights and stop the transgender ideology from taking over, you can go and check that out, the sound file of the giant rock coming through the window and pictures and all that. That was on last week. What was that, the 11th? Yep, the 11th, February the 11th, 2024, so all the drama is there. This week, we're just going to talk about the evil federal government.
Yeah, just that.
We've moved on. We've moved on
only
to the evil,
the evil government.
Just the evil federal government. So I deal a lot with the evil federal government. Nathan, how's it working out for you guys in Montana these days?
Well, we're staying busy, that's for sure, on just... just life and in general, obviously. But yeah, a lot going on.
Yeah, they've got bad plans. Every time you turn around, more bad plans.
Yeah, for sure. There's every time you come to an end of year and you come into the holiday season, that's a prime time for federal agencies to drop some rules on the Federal Register, and that's. They did that through the Forest Service on a couple items, and so that's so some of my focus recently has been on some Forest Service items and what they're doing there. We can discuss a little bit of that today probably, and but I just want to say too, appreciate you guys having me on. I was hoping to have another individual with me that's very brilliant in relationship to the property clause and Article 1 and so maybe on a future call, maybe that can be set up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I get it. Sometimes you try to get two people who have the same, you know, to get the same schedule and get it all together, and that doesn't always work. That is absolutely something. We're going to talk about this stuff pretty much forever. I mean, this is like year number 14. Kind of did this as a lark 14 years ago. Thought, oh, yeah, never done it before. Okay, it'd be kind of fun. And then here we are. Yikes. Yikes. Now we're in. Now, let's see. Now we're old enough to be in the Social Security zone. we grew old talking crap about the government on the radio. It's got to be a country song about that somewhere. Oh man. So where would you like to start today? There was a lot of material. I really liked both of the articles that you gave us. I don't know if you want to discuss those specifically, but they were both really quite good.
Yeah, I think so. I'll touch on those. I guess I sent over kind of a title of where we are,
yep,
where we came from, and where we're going. So yeah, I think we can start with where we are. Those documents you posted are both recent, pretty fresh off the press. One of them was actually out of the Buckeye Institute. Their economic department are the ones that... And I had it pulled up in front of me, and I'm not seeing it. But anyways, that one, they did a simulation of a small corn farm and applied the net zero policies in finding economic impacts of applying many of the things that are trying to be pushed through, and showed a 34% increase in operating costs just based on the carbon pricing framework that's being proposed out there. And then obviously there was a significant percentage of increase of cost to the consumer,
of course,
on the other end of that. So it was good to see the Buckeye Institute putting that out, though, because otherwise it's just one hand clapping out there on all this net zero and climate policy. And then alongside that, the 12 state agricultural commissioners at the state levels also issued a letter January 29th of this year regarding an impact of Net Zero Banking Alliance on agriculture and food security. And since that letter was issued, some of those banks have actually withdrawn from that alliance. So that's some good news that there's some pushback and pressure coming from some of our states and other some academic institutions that are finally putting out some good economic stuff on these items. And then the other thing, just to quickly mention, is the natural asset company rule that was submitted by the New York Stock Exchange to the Security and Exchange Commission after 24, or not, well, maybe it was 24, I can't remember, maybe 12, I can't remember how many, but Kansas and Utah AG's offices led the way, and then, you know, American Stewards of Liberty, Margaret Byfield, and then a lot of other people really pushed back on that rule, and that also was later withdrawn by the New York Stock Exchange. So there's been some good news in that front of some pushback and some of these agencies stepping back on a couple of these items. So finally nice to see some of that at least.
Well, let's not forget, too, the private industry backing away from a lot of this craziness, too. I mean, a lot of this DEI stuff they put out there, BlackRock and some of these other ones are saying, you know what, enough's enough. This is just not working. And they wouldn't do that unless there was, like, a major negative impact on their business. I mean, a lot of the decisions they make, we all know, have some sort of a negative impact. It's probably not big enough to worry about. But for them to back out of a lot of these things are a clear indicator that it's just not working. And people are getting fed up with it.
Well, it's expensive.
It is.
And the idea that... Yeah, the benefits are unclear too.
Well,
you know, the idea that it's going to solve all these problems, and it's like,
it always seems like the consumer cost of a lot of this stuff is always way down on the list of talking points. You know, they talk about all the phony good stuff that's going to happen, but you know, they never mention the increased cost to the consumer for most of these programs, and I think that's that's part of the big impact with inflation is are these a lot of these policies.
Yeah, I would agree. That's the relief with the Buckeye Institute is they took that into consideration. And the problem with federal regulations and rules that regulate our industries or our natural resource industries in particular, the rules are always finalized. The regulatory framework is finalized and basically set in stone well in advance, usually before the consumers actually see the inflationary impact of that regulation coming out of their own personal wallets. So that's, and agencies are supposed to, under existing congressional law, to project, you know, in a reasonable fashion, the cost benefit, you know, through a cost benefit analysis or whatever else, right, to project what are those impacts going to be on those consumers. And, you know, what I'm finding is the social justice and environmental justice stuff is being so entrenched in agency priorities currently that, you know, like they're doing, EPA is rewriting, doing regulatory changes for the meat and poultry processing facilities to regulate indirect discharges. And in the Federal Register notice for that rule, they cite, you know, there's like total aggregate of $200 million of annual costs. And then they tout 94 some odd million dollars of monetized benefits, but the monetized benefits are coming from carbon sequestration, ecosystem services, environmental justice. So where are they getting that $95 million value from? They're arbitrarily placing a dollar figure on something that's not tangible,
right,
and currently being traded on the market. But instead of them being like, how, instead of them focusing on how's this going to affect the currently non-regulated processing facilities that are owned by individuals out there and the counties and states that have them, they're more worried about putting a arbitrary dollar figure on environmental justice, ecosystem services, and social things that, and those things can never be accurately determined except for on a case by case basis. And so that's what's happening, though. It's the focal point of the agencies at this point is very misdirected.
Well, they're not.
And they're being called out, but yeah,
they're not even living up to their own mission. I mean, at the risk of, you know, causing me to fly into a rage, the Klamath Dam scam, where they're you know, removing four dams under the guise of creating 400 miles of habitat. Well, it's like, I don't know, 30 miles of river or something. 400 mile. The 400 mile number comes from every drop of water between here and the lower part of Oregon. Oh, that's part of the 400 miles. So it's not the public would think that was 400 miles here to somewhere. That isn't 400 miles. And you look at the regulatory stuff. That's all been done through regulatory process. None of it was done by congressional action. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission said, well, I guess you can do it, and California can regulate. Since they have their own EPA, they can regulate the Clean Water Act aspect of it. But are you kidding me? They've killed everything in the river. I mean, you get dead fish everywhere. Yeah. These are the same fish the farmers were being fined for just months ago. You can't, you know, these are endangered species they're wiping out. And they sat right there in a meeting I went to last week and said, well, you know, we anticipated all this. This is all to be expected. I mean, they're supposed to be about fish and wildlife now. California changed their name. So they're all about fish and wildlife. Well, I'm sorry, but the deer are getting stuck in the mud and either dying from just struggle or having to be shot. You've got beavers and fish and crawdads and the whole host of things that live in the river can't live in it because it's black. But that's okay.
Yeah.
But that's okay. We can do that now. And so they asked, like, what about the tributaries? What about that, where they've got all these projects, and, oh, my God, you probably have it in Montana, too, with all the fish screens and all this drama to make more fish? All those fish are going to go to the river?
Yeah.
Boom, dead.
Oh yeah, but they said that they won't actually go to the river now. They'll stay in the tributary.
They're going to stay in the tributary because they all have email, I guess, and they found out that the river is black. I don't know how that works. I mean, you have people who think that fish and game can,
fish and wildlife.
They're fish and game because it goes with fun and games. You know what I mean? Fish and wildlife doesn't say fun and games, so it's not fun for me. People think, they should have people along the side of the river to keep the animals from getting stuck in the mud. Like, it's 200 miles. Like 200 miles.
Yeah.
Well, they have a lot of people. Really? So the general public, even the people who might be on our team really kind of need to get a grip a little bit. I don't think people realize what's going on in rural America, honestly. But see, at the risk of being on a tirade, and then I was on a tirade, we have to take a really quick break. Sorry. Well, not sorry. Sorry, not sorry. And then we'll come back with our guest.
Excuse me.
We're not coming back for a break.
For some reason, I thought it was 30 because I wasn't thinking. So take a little time while I get this song up.
This is how things went haywire last week. It was we're taking a break, we're not taking a break, and then kabam. Although last week did have a great song. It's worth listening to the clip just to hear the song that was queued up ahead of time. Did a bad, bad thing. That's a fun song. But we'll be back with our guest, Nathan Deshmaker, up there in Montana, in the great state. Maybe. Maybe not. What's happening in there? How are we doing? We're doing good? No pressure? I'm the Jeopardy song for him.
I found it.
Okay. You're listening to We the People yet again with more live radio buffoonery right here on KCNR.
Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. In a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I'll stay.
See a hat trick?
We're back.
What?
Very few ads.
What? Got very quiet. All right, Nathan. Now that I've been ranting and raving about the Klamath, which probably will happen again, just, you know, spoiler alert, it's probably going to happen again.
Yeah.
But honestly, I mean, every single thing that they are regulating, like now California gets to do its own clean water permit. Well, I'm sorry, but you couldn't put 50 million cubic yards of sediment in a river, ever, anywhere, and kill endangered species.
And get a permit.
And get a permit.
That's okay.
So now that they're the licensee on the project, then they're underwriting it, now they can do whatever they want because they write their... I mean, it's like the, you know, that whole thing about the fox in the hen house, it's like almost sort of trite. I mean...
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing in Montana with the solar. They just put out a plan for the utility solar development on BLM lands in the Northwest. And, yeah, if it's putting up solar panels they're just fine with streamlining everything. And meanwhile, a rancher, in some cases, depending on the field office you're in and the BLM in the region, can't even get through the process to put in a water development, which is in law called a rangeland improvement. You know, you can't even accomplish those things, but they're opening up 22 million acres so that they can install solar, utility-scale solar farms on BLM-administered lands. And so they're opening up 22 million acres, but the plan only calls for 700,000 acres, I think, is what they want to get to. But they're opening up 22 million acres, so they have maximum flexibility.
Yeah.
That's what I want. I want maximum flexibility. That's it. I want to, the speed limit is anywhere from 50 to 90 so that I can have maximum flexibility. Because, you know, that works everywhere. That's how all the regulations are written. Maximum flexibility.
So when we talk about rules, new rules, maybe you could tell me what's the difference between a rule and the law? Because we have laws covering much of this already, but now we have new rules to support the laws,
right? Or make,
it's like they're new laws.
This is right up Nathan's alley.
Yeah, so, and that's a really good question, and it's, there's some simple answers to it, but there's some broader issues that get discussed in that discussion. But a rule, agencies that promulgate rules, you know, policy manuals, guidance documents, things like that, mm-hmm. don't have any real teeth in them and are, don't have the force of law at the end of the day. But an agency that amends, say, a resource management plan under the Federal Land Policy Management Act and goes through the full NEPA process in doing that, and that sets the policy for how the lands are managed and et cetera. And when that goes through what's called a record of decision through the full process, public process and whatnot, that rule then becomes, in a certain sense, it's not law in the context of, it didn't come directly from the Congress, obviously, the sole lawmaking right. power under the Constitution.
As it should
but
be.
It does, but the Congress has allowed in some of the, that's, some of the problem that we ultimately face in the administrative state and bureaucracy on the federal front is probably Congress delegating, entering into a non-delegation realm in passing certain rulemaking powers and regulatory functions over to the executive branch. And
yep.
So it's not a simple answer to the question because it's kind of a convoluted mess on the way it's all functioning. But what I will say, records of decisions through the land use planning processes have some level of binding authority on those lands. And that's what the Biden administration is doing with these forest plans and everything that's moving right now. Their goal is to get records of decisions on all these things that are moving. The utility scale solar, all that's in process. Those aren't final rules yet. They're going through the process in analyzing and setting alternatives and putting it out for public comment. And then after it goes through that whole process, then there's usually a protest period when they issue a final draft of the document and what the rule does. And then it becomes a final rule with a record of decision. And that's what they wanted. That's what this administration is really pushing to do with the Forest Service amendments, the sage-grouse amendments. And there's 98 resource management plans for the sage-grouse opened up right now. And before Christmas last year, the Forest Service opened up 128 Forest Service unit plans, which is all of them virtually, for managing for old growth and carbon sequestration. But what that does is it opens up all those management plans so that now the agencies can take these policies, which are not binding, mm-hmm. infuse them into the amendment process. You know, there's bad policy that agencies have been promulgating for the last 3 years in manuals and directives. So what's happening now is they really want to get those things weaved into the resource management plans and get a record of decision on that. Because right now, indigenous knowledge is not a baseline for decision making through a lot of this process. And that's one thing they're pushing so they can get in those amendments on the land planning front. And what that will do is make it, if we have an incumbent administration in the federal presidency that's the other side of this, it's easy to undo policy. It's not easy to undo final amendments and rules
right.
that these agencies are promulgating.
And as far as enforcement of those rules, when push comes to shove, can they actually prosecute somebody for breaking a rule?
All day.
There's penalties attached on certain things, yeah. I mean, if you violate, it's enforceable under land management planning stuff. I mean, there's been people in Utah, even in Montana in the past, that have been raided for taking what they consider artifacts off of BLM and have been administered lands. So there's very definitely an enforcement arm that's been used when you are accused or do or violate some of those provisions. That and where that comes from is in these rules.
But don't they ultimately have to be tied to a law?
Are they technically?
Well, so that's so there's where the issue really is. So what's happening? Congress has set priorities for the Forest Service, for example. The congressional statutes delegate powers to the executive branch and the administration and the USDA Forest Service. And there's under congressional law, those lands are supposed to be inventoried and monitored in a way to facilitate mature growth and a reasonable flow and receipt of timber for the benefit of local communities, local economies. That's in statute.
Right.
And it's tied into the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act. And multiple use and sustained yield are obvious terms, multiple use and sustained yield. And as you guys know, the forest wood products industry in much of the federal lands in the Northwest, because of the spotted owl and other things, has already been almost entirely hamstrung. And now they want to reserve all these old growth forests and make them off limits from any timber harvesting through these 128 plan amendments. And they're doing it not based, see, that's the thing, is they're not following the congressional priorities here. Congress, I haven't seen yet in my review of the statutes anywhere that old growth is ever mentioned and prioritized by the Congress to Bureau of Land Management or Forest Service to prioritize old growth forests for carbon sequestration. It's not in statute. So they're doing wholesale changes across the forest reserves through these amendments based on priorities that are not coming from the Congress, but are coming from, it's coming out of Executive Order 14072, the Biden executive order that started the process to have Forest Service start to focus on carbon sequestration and preserving and reserving old growth forests. So that executive order led to an assessment that was developed by the Forest Service, an inventory of old growth forests. But there's no statute that directs the agency to inventory for that priority.
Imagine that.
But that's what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah. And that, well, you have a bunch of things that are happening. So while they're doing that, we're not managing timber. I mean, out here,
exactly.
Where we are, we're not managing for maintenance. So maybe the whole thing doesn't burn down, which I think is amazing. So as all of the foresters in the Forest Service have been replaced with ologists of one form or fashion, your actual forestry practices take a backseat or just flat go away.
Well, there's very, very few that are foresters that understand how to manage a healthy forest. I don't think that's one of their priorities.
But if it involves cutting, see, that's not.
Yeah.
Nobody sees that as creating health. On rangeland, cattle out on rangeland is really beneficial if done properly, and yet that's seen as
destroying the
heresy. Got to let everything just sit. But you can put solar panels on it. That's really weird. How many bazillions of acres was that? Is it 20? What'd you say? 20?
Like 22 million acres.
Okay, that's what I thought you said. That's crazy.
And solar panels are, no outcry from the environmentalists.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you increase the heat on the land. So if it's near farmland, messes up the crop production because it changes the temperature. They put them in big enough solar panel blobs. Do they still kill birds because birds think those are lakes and they land on them and burn up? Is that still a thing?
I've heard of that. Yeah, yeah. I've never been around large scale utility solar systems, but they want to push them all over though.
Yeah, from the sky they look like lakes. So the birds come down, sit on them, bzz, burn up because they're really really hot. I mean, but it's kind of like the windmills too. I mean, they chop up all sorts of birds and endangered species and stuff like that. And yet, you know, where exactly are the animal, like up on the Klamath, for instance? It's funny, as we get near a break, suddenly I want to go there. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Where's PETA?
What's wrong with me? But where is PETA? You know, where all these animals are being killed.
Yeah.
Up on the dope grows that we've covered endlessly. They're cooking and eating dogs, for God's sake. You know, where are the animal rights people? I don't understand that. They're busy throwing paint at people who eat chicken in a restaurant, but you know, actual murder of actual animals, you know, that are out there supposed to be protected. I don't know. I think it's kind of making people, all right, I'll be first. It's making people a little crazy. It's making me crazy. Because it doesn't make any sense.
I'll testify to that.
You shut up over there. No ride home for you. That's it. And so maybe we've got to take a break here in a minute or so. So I don't want to cause you to do what I do, which is, you know, fly into a rage and get cut off. But honestly, I think we need to look a little bit in our discussion today on what can people do? Because the bad part is we talk about this and it sort of sounds like the byline is, and by the way, there's nothing you can do. So you might as well just roll over and accept it and don't go to any meetings locally. Don't write letters. Don't. And that's not what we're saying. We're not saying disengage because nothing can be done. And you do.
Yeah.
You work on this all the time. So how about this? Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I know we have you as a hostage for the second hour, but let's kind of start to unpack some of the things that people could do, especially if they're not, you know, experts in this field, but they care about it, and especially if they live there. So our guest is Nathan Deshmaker. Should do that again. And you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Welcome to your life. There's no turning back. Even while we sleep, we will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature.
First class on a flight from New York to Los Angeles. Kind of making small talk, killing time, flirting with the flight attendants. 30,000 feet above could be Oklahoma. Just a bunch of square cornfields and wheat farms, man, it all looks the same. Miles and miles of back roads and highways connecting little towns with funny names. Who'd want to live down there in the middle of nowhere? They've never drove through Indiana. Met the man who plowed that earth, planted that seed, busted his ass for you and me. You're called a harvest moon in Kansas. And they'd understand why God made those flyover states.
I always like that song because it's kind of sad, but that is the way it is viewed. You have big populations on the coasts of this country who really don't know a whole lot about what's going on in the middle and truly do not understand the origin of our food. Blows my mind. I got a call not too long ago. A guy was all mad that one of the refuges up north didn't have any water in it. I was like, well, they can't get water in it unless it goes through the farms, because the farmers are the ones that pump the water over into the refuge. So when they cut the water off to the farms, there's no water for the refuge. Well, I don't care about farmers. I just want water in the refuge. Okay, well, it's a plumbing problem. This is basic plumbing. The water comes from the street, goes through the pipes, comes out the faucet. You can't get it out the faucet if it doesn't come from the street. Like, what the heck? But there is a weird... I asked him, too. I go, where do you think your food... Where do you plan to get your food if we cut off all the farmers? They think they're all just somehow making a mint. The farmers and ranchers are just getting fat on the taxpayers' dime, and somehow we need to, I don't know, make it harder for them? Like, yeah, that's possible?
There's a big disconnect. People don't understand the food chain very
You get
well.
That a lot, Nathan? I mean, the policy stuff certainly skews that way. Is Nathan in the cone of silence? Can you, like, unmute Nathan?
What's that?
There we go. Sorry.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. We have to actually push a button here to make it so we can hear you.
Oh.
But I don't. But I'm in a different room, so it's hard for me to do that. I was using my mind, though. I was trying to push a button with my mind. So tons of the policy you deal with just crushes agriculture.
Well, not just agriculture. I mean, the thing is, the free market economy is made up of both efficient and non-efficient functions at every level that contributes to the complex modern industrial systems that we take for granted today that gives pretty ready and affordable access to a lot of material products and goods and services and food, etc. But central planners approach it economic. When they're sitting in their swivel chairs and applying their central economic plans to that market framework, they look at a spreadsheet and say, well, this business and company or industry here is inefficient and these ones are efficient, so we're going to get rid of those and work just with these. But that kind of thinking fails to recognize that it's the independent functions of those other, even the what they would consider an inefficient industry or business, actually makes up a part of the whole framework that contributes to the efficiency of the ones they're looking at as being the most efficient.
Yeah. That's
so
true,
there's,
if the guy,
so there's
if
economic
the guy doesn't make the parts
reasoning
for the,
that... Yeah. Go ahead.
If the guy doesn't make... If nobody makes the parts for the machinery, then the machinery doesn't function. So, yeah, it's all
exactly.
tied together.
Exactly.
Sure.
So when it comes to the agricultural industry, the cattle industry in particular, there's some rules like the meat and poultry processing rule that maybe not initially, but for sure downstream will have impacts. Because when you force a small meat processing facility or feedlot to put in pretreatment systems and new filtration systems and all these different things, that's an increased cost. And it either puts that business out of business, or they either pass those increased costs upstream to the producers, which are the ranchers actually out there raising the cattle, or they pass them downstream to the consumers, or they do both, because those costs are redirected to maintain production. But the way they're coming after the ranching and farming and agriculture and our energy sectors is kind of a somewhat fascist, unholy alliance between international banking finance and government through the executive branch, not only of the United States, but some of our states, as you're talking about with California. California is a part of the U.S. Climate Alliance, which is a coalition of state governors that are committed to these international compacts as well. So that's where a lot of those policies are coming from, very much top-down. And the way it gets to the rancher is they use the financial control and leverage to establish ESG-type policies in the finance realm. And then when you're going to get a loan to finance to buy a ranch from your neighbor or whatever, now they set those conditions so they can push people out of finance and having finance options to be able to purchase lands and engage in those industries.
Explain to people what ESG is for the folks that don't know, and spoiler alert, we're doing a show about that with a guy on March 3rd that'll just be about the whole ESG thing. But for people who hear it all the time that don't really know what it is and what that means in your industry, maybe do that.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, to me, it's confusing just because it's tied in. So ESG is environment, social, and governance. It's just an acronym for those terms, but it's tied into the carbon credit type frameworks and whatnot. And that's what these banks, like from the, that's what our state ag commissioners were calling out in these domestic American banks, was in part that, the ESG, because they were involved in the Net Zero Banking Alliance. And whether it's the ESG or what they're doing for the natural asset companies and all those things, it just creates a mechanism to put, in this case, nature on the balance sheet. Because that's what they're ultimately doing here, is that's where they get these ecosystem services, values, and everything else. So they want to monetize nature when it comes down to it. So the whole ESG framework is connected to the efforts that are taking place in Security and Exchange Commission and elsewhere at the government level. And this is where this fascist framework develops, because it's the banking institutions that are pushing the ESG frameworks within banking policy and finance policy in the international realm of things. And then you have domestic agencies in the executive branch that are promulgating and bringing forward mechanisms of regulation and policy that allows for tapping into those international finance markets based on not producing, like cutting a tree down and making lumber and marketing that to your community so they can build a house with it or whatever. No, it's there's a ridge there, there's trees on it. Let's place an arbitrary value on that and allow people to lease or permit or lease that as a non-use, and then market that into the international finance realm as a carbon credit to offset some multinational companies' emissions. So that's not the best definition of ESG per se, but I wanted to just say that, because the ESG framework ties together with a whole bunch of other moving parts, and it's not good. What is good, these state ag commissioners, just really quick, I'll read this one little part from and what they put in this letter they issued to these banks calling out this Net Zero Banking Alliance. They say, due to the potential impacts to agriculture, we are seeking more information regarding what appears to be troubling environmental commitments by your banks that target our farmers, ranchers, and agricultural producers with grave consequences for consumers and that undermine the security of our food supply. And they talk about how these policies want to cut the meat industry, basically, meat consumption in half by 2050. That's what they're,
and
this
what,
alliance
and what better way to
is pushing for.
What better way to do that than make it unaffordable?
Well, they've done that in California. I don't know what eggs cost in your state, but they're hitting $5 a dozen now. But we have happy chickens because they're cage free, and I don't know how they think regulations like that aren't going to impact the end user, because they don't care. No, they don't care.
Yeah.
And yet they'll, when the impacts do hit, and people, are at the grocery store paying $5, they don't understand why. They think maybe the chicken guys are getting fat. That's not it.
You cut back on domestic fuel production too. So then you raise the cost on trucking.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's hitting it at every
turn.
And you got Barbara Lee. Let's not give her a pass here. She wants minimum wage to be $50 an hour.
Yeah, that won't.
So that won't affect the price of food.
No.
I mean, can you imagine? Every farmer's got to pay every single person who does everything on their farm $50 an hour or more.
That shouldn't have too much of an impact on the cost of things. It'll just put people out of business.
We'd have to just get fat on word salad. That's it.
There you are.
We would just have to be bloated on word salad. We could listen to bureaucrats talk all day and just feel full. Or maybe that's just me. Maybe that's what I do for fun. I did that the other day. I had to go to this big long thing on the Klamath. And yeah, at the end I thought, man, if word salad had calories, dang, none of us would be able to get out of the room. Be unbelievable. This isn't a new all this stuff that we're talking about isn't new. I mean, none of these things are new, but
no. But what's new is what this ESG thing. You know, I don't know if people realize this, but farms operate on borrowed money. Ranchers operate on borrowed money. But when they go to a bank, and the bank says, "Oh, you're not falling in line with our environmental guidelines. You need to do X, Y, Z before we can give you a loan." This is all relatively new, and a lot of these, even corporate farms, aren't prepared to make the kind of changes these banks are requiring them to make. So what happens? You either go out of business or
your product is unaffordable.
Exactly.
How much of that is hitting in your industry, Nathan? Is it just across the board, or are there some industries getting hit more right now than others?
Well, I guess what do you mean by hit precisely?
Well,
just with inflation or impacts on profitability, or
back in the late 70s, you know, they basically came at timber. You know, timber was in the crosshairs. And so, you know, the spotted owl had to go through the whole spotted owl thing and crush that industry. Here, anyway, they came after mining. So they claimed mining put mercury in the river, which is a bizarre fiction. But then they came after mining. So they've kind of like picked these off one by one.
So in that context, with the the cattle industry, and I will say, there's a lot of land aggregated in agricultural production. Farm and ranches make up a significant amount of private land ownership throughout the country. So it's important that remains as such, because it's the disaggregated ownership of lands and in the hands of literally hundreds of thousands of people that are functioning somewhat independently on the market. But that's where, so the problem is where the pigeonhole, there's already a bottleneck in the beef supply industry already, because there's already a very centralized beef packing system with four main packers pretty conglomerated and controlling a lot of the packing industry. So there's already a centralization there. It's like a wine glass. You know, you have the base of the wine glass in on the table. That's your producers. That's the ranchers, farmers, or whatever out on the ground. And then there's this little tiny bottleneck that goes through the packing industry, and then the top is the consumers. And
that's the way a lot of the beef supply chain
already is, and it's going to get worse with these trajectories they're pushing.
Of course. We're going to come back with our guest, Nathan Deshmaker.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that, because I hear a lot of
158.
A lot of chit-chat about how the
producers
are controlling the cost of the beef. But I guess I'm kind of curious what your take is on how did the price of beef get so high? I mean, you go in right now and try to buy a steak in the grocery store, it's $20. It never used to be that high. So I'm kind of curious what's...
In 20 seconds or less, Nathan, can you explain the entire trajectory of the beef pricing structure?
Well, no, when we come back, we can talk about what's happening there and why just in the last few years has it gotten... I mean, a lot of beef producers sold all their cows and are out. They're not making the money.
Yeah.
It's not the guys raising the cows.
Gosh, you squeeze the producers and it costs more, huh?
Yeah.
What a clever idea. All right, we'll pick that up on the other side. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm gonna do bad things, do it like it's nothing. Being bad has never felt so good. I'm gonna do bad things, you won't see it coming. What you said, I've been thinking of doing bad things to you.
My name is Aaron Ryan. It's kind of loud.
Hi, Aaron.
I felt like I should start singing or just start shouting. All right. So, tell us what you got, Bill.
Well, our sponsor this second hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They have right now a full line of John Deere tractors and attachments in stock, ready to go. Spring is almost here. You want to get lined up and get ready to go before the rush comes. Go in and see them. They have a fully staffed service department, parts department. They can get you ready to go when spring is sprung. And
it'll be too late.
Yeah, once it gets busy, you're going to get in line. So go over and see them. Get stocked up. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. And you can give them a call. If you have questions, 530-226-9226. They'd be happy to help you out over the phone. Or you could go online and get them at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da! It's good. We have a nice tractor sponsor while we're talking about ag and the predicament they face. So, anyway.
So yeah, we were talking about
back to Nathan.
Cost of agricultural products, but beef in particular, that is something that I think most people can relate to. You know, you go in and used to be, you know, you could buy a hamburger at a decent price. Now it's $5, $6, $7 a pound for hamburger, which is ridiculous. What's going on there, Nathan? What can you tell us? And who's making the money? And you know, you were talking about a bottleneck. Is that the problem?
And we got to turn Nathan back on again.
On.
Okay.
Hello.
Yeah, sorry about that. I was willing the button to be pushed.
So the bottleneck I was referring to is just making the point that the Packers already have a large consolidation of the supply chain for the beef industry. They're all are alternatives. And you know, with the COVID deal, several states have started to put into place some meat processing feedlots and meat processing type facilities to process like we used to beef at more of a localized level. Obviously, like Montana, we produce way more beef than we can consume internally, so there's a lot that goes out. But the danger with the bottleneck, and this will get kind of to the pricing a little bit, I guess, but it serves as a leverage both ways. If you can control that pass through in the supply chain. It's leveraged to control producer by price or whatever else, and it's also leveraged to reach back and control the consumer. I meant if I said producer there, and then reach back also to the producer who's actually raising the animal and the livestock for the market. So this meat and poultry processing rule that EPA is pushing right now, currently, which would regulate indirect discharges from these smaller processing facilities. That'll further centralize the meat processing industries and serve as a larger leverage back up to the producers, because the producers, if there's alternatives, you can go different directions on how you market your product. But if you consolidate it all too much, there are no viable alternatives when you don't have a local population to consume all of your product and you have to put it out. And if you have no alternatives of where that product goes, then the packing side can reach back to the producer and start telling how they, down to the level of how they're to run their property even. And
oh, wow.
to report on different things. That's, it's not there yet, but you can see that in the forecast of the trajectory. And they've done this in Europe. That's why the farmers are filling the streets of Paris and in other countries and in Brussels and everywhere in Europe over the EU policies on climate, because they started doing what we're implementing now 10 years ago in some of those countries. And those farmers have, let me put it this way, Frederick Hayek in his Constitutional Liberty, he said, we must look to other countries if we are to become aware of the full extent to which such policies systematically pursued are liable to impose restrictions on the farmer or rancher and turn him into the most regimented and supervised of all producers. It's already like that in Europe, and that's why they've gone to that point. So my view with us now in America in the ag industry and the same similar policies that they're pushing, we shouldn't wait till we have to drive our tractors down Main Street to oppose this type of idiotic economic transitions that they're imposing on our not just the ag and packing side of things, but there are energy sectors and everything else. And that, so in summary, the cost on the shelf for any of those products, not just beef, is going to go up because they're increasing costs in the energy sector and with the fuel and the natural gas and everything else we need to maintain production and manufacturing. And so the price that comes on the shelf is not more complex than just one thing in the beef supply chain. It's also the energy sector and the other things that are taking place. And it causes economic confusion is what it does, which is the breeding ground for totalitarian ideas.
We'll just let that sit. It was like a little mic drop moment there. So keep going on that. Keep going on that idea. For people who go, oh, he said totalitarian, what is he even talking about?
Well, to control, I guess, and that's not a direct answer necessarily to what you guys were asking, I guess, on the price side. And I'm not an expert on studying out a lot of, I'm familiar with the beef supply chain because obviously I function in it to one degree or another as a producer myself. So I have a little bit of knowledge there, but I'm by no means an expert on the supply chain and all those other things.
No,
other
but that's
than where
all
I've dealt
part
with
of
it policy wise.
It is. You increase, and the thing is, I suppose we could say that, like, when we stopped allowing like little kids to work in factories and we required, you know, people to wear hard hats and not stick their hands in the machinery, and you know, we kind of tidied up some of that I'm sure increased cost in factories and assembly lines and all those things. But that was a trade-off I think most people, I mean, if they got to vote on it, say, you know, are you willing to pay 5 cents more for the mirror on the side of your car if, you know, nobody's going to get injured while they're doing it based on some new rules? Most people would say, yeah, okay, that's acceptable. But the stuff they're doing is weird fiction that doesn't actually improve anything and absolutely doesn't improve the product you're producing.
No.
It disenfranchises the individual in the process.
Sure it does. And it, you know, most markets are controlled by supply and demand. As far as the food market goes, there's always going to be a demand. And that demand's not going to get, it's not going to be less. It's going to be more. So I would think that the supply side needs to compensate for more production. But the regulations that they put on farmers and ranchers tend to decrease production, which increases price. I do see on some products, less products on the shelves because you can't get them. you can't get them because they're not producing
yeah.
them. And that's, I guess that's my rub is, what can people do? I mean, as an end user, your leverage is the only leverage you have is to stop buying a product if for whatever reason you don't agree with it or whatever, you stop buying it. But when you have food as the product, the demand is always going to be there. People are always going to buy food, and they're going to quit buying other things in order to afford to buy food.
Yeah, that's true.
So I guess I'm not still not real clear on how they can decrease the supply of food and expect it to be affordable. Because let's face it, you've got people out there that don't make a lot of money. They're not being compensated in any way to offset the increased price of food. And I mean that's a basic essential. And
yeah.
what can they do?
Well, exactly. It's well, and what also happens is the alternatives are lost on what you only get. You know, essentially, plants. The state government has never been a successful farmer. First
no.
off, and second, when you centrally try to centrally plan, what they need to do is allow the market to work and function. And those things get worked out, and mm-hmm. they want to force regulatory layers over that. And when you tamper with that in different areas, it sends ripples through the whole system, and it's
sure.
and it's a mess. And that's in some ways where we are with the out of control regulations. I mean, you need stable policy and regulation for private capital investment, especially in our natural resource industries. You're not going to make millions of dollars of capital investments for a mining operation or a timber mill or buying a ranch that has a bunch of federal permits and leases attached to it unless you have a stable policy environment that guarantees a return on that investment-backed expectation over, you know, a pretty good amount of time, because millions of dollars of investment in those things, it takes 20 years in many cases or more for getting substantive returns on those investments. And if you can just flip-flop on regulations from day to day, that's not a stable thing that encourages private investment. So right now you have a bunch of companies just running. It's kind of like in that movie Braveheart, when William Wallace calls out the nobles and he says, "You're so busy squabbling over the scraps from Longshanks' table that you've lost your God-given right for something better."
Right.
You know, all these companies are running after the Inflation Reduction Act money to build a solar farm and to put up a wind deal, but that's all subsidized. That's not a part of the free market. That's picking winners and losers in the marketplace, and I would submit to you that's where the greatest increase of costs we're going to start seeing is if they continue to tamper with our energy sector. That's where the pain is going to be felt, because energy is not like all the other economic things that go in and out of the economic framework. Energy really is the, in my opinion, the hub from which all other economic transactions and things take place in the modern industrial society we live in.
Oh, that's definitely
so. If
the
they can
base,
take I that mean, out, that's not good.
No. I mean, if when energy costs more, whether it be
yep.
oil, gas, electricity,
or you phase out parts of your oil, right? You get rid of natural gas because it's
mm-hmm.
evil and bad.
You find a more expensive alternative, and there's where the problem is they're going to continue to produce a product at a higher price or a lesser quality, because I think they know, the government knows, there's always going to be a consumer out there, and they aren't going to have a choice. They're going to pay that higher price, whether it's based on energy costs or whatever,
mm-hmm.
That's where they've kind of got us, until we can get, you're right, we have to get the energy part of it under control to where we can supply industry with cheaper energy to produce more products at a more affordable price. I mean, it's kind of basic, really. I don't know where the big mystery is there.
Big mystery is it doesn't fit the narrative.
Yeah.
Therein lies the mystery. And you can't control it. The whole thing is all about control. Are you seeing, I know you are, but how much, how about this, Nathan, are you seeing about control of water where you are? Because here, the battleground right now is water.
Yes, and that's very actually perfect, because that was one of the things I was hoping to touch on. Huh. In this conversation is water, because this EPA rule ties into water, because the processing facilities they want to regulate. See, there's about 5,050 existing MPP, which are meat and poultry processing facilities currently out there in the industry, in the nation. Only about 150 of those are currently regulated by the EPA under the Clean Water Act. And the reason that they're regulated is because they're directly discharging into the what's called the waters of the U.S., the navigable systems. So this rule, one of the things this rule would do, would allow EPA to regulate indirect discharges. The EPA has never, since 1975, I believe, they have always regulated only direct discharges. So this rule is actually flying in the face of a recent Supreme Court decision from last year, the Idaho couple, the Sacketts versus the EPA. And the court, in that case, Supreme Court, that case did two or three things, but two primary things I'm going to touch on, and that is, one, it clearly defined the regulatory limits of EPA's reach in relationship to what the navigable waters are. The waters of the United States, as stated in the Clean Water Act, were defined in the Sackett versus EPA, and they limited it to the actual rivers, streams, lakes, oceans, and only wetlands that are directly adjacent to them. And the other thing the Sackett case did is it reasserted that land and water use are core traditional state lies under traditional state authority. Even the Clean Water Act itself defers to states as the primary regulator of the water within its borders. So that's not a direct answer to your question about the water, but it's indirectly. The point is, yes, water is an issue in a lot of different ways in a lot of different states. They're going after water rights through the refuge systems. This EPA rule would regulate indirect discharges, which flies in the face of the decision of the Sackett versus EPA, which just said you can't reach that far, but they're reaching that far right now. So the problem is, you guys in California or Washington State, some states are kind of worse than the federal government when it comes to water. So that's a whole other...
Yeah.
I'm making the case for state supremacy in relationship to internal affairs that deal with water and land use, et cetera. But when you get into states like California and Washington... You got to take a little bit different approach, because now it's not just the federal government that's pushing all this stuff. The states in parallel are worse. So,
yeah, here the state is, absolutely worse. It's really weird. You know, people are like, can't the federal government come in and do something? And it's like, what alternative universe are we living in?
That's
please,
what you
federal
want.
Government, come and save us. And that actually is a sensible thing to say.
So just really quick, I wanted to mention something on that. In my opinion, California in a market framework, if others, I mean, we're shipping energy to you guys and et cetera, et cetera. So you're not self-sustaining with the policy.
No, not even close.
And if California and Washington weren't being propped up by all these dollars that are flowing into them through these Inflation Reduction Act and the energy that Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming are sending to them, your people would, what they're doing is they're artificially subsidizing what otherwise would be painful for the consumers in your state. I mean, it's painful, but it's not so painful you're going to leave your house and do something about it. Like the guys in Europe that are getting in their tractors and driving through the streets and blockading main streets and business sections in Paris. So they want to keep that balance to keep the people, you know, we can put a little bit of pain on them, but let's subsidize and alleviate that what otherwise would be something that would trigger them to actually say, we're tired of this, we need different leadership. So no offense to you guys in California or whoever in one of these other states, I am of the opinion, just like a poor person who keeps living on handouts and won't take initiative, we can't keep bailing them out. Let them experience the full weight of their bad decisions, and the population itself will either leave there or they'll actually stand up and say, this is not good. Our life, our liberty, our property, the guarantee within the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution of the United States and our state constitution, we're being deprived of those. The whole purpose of government is to safeguard that domain. So that's my two cents on the issue with these states that are pushing this. If they weren't subsidized, they wouldn't have the success they're having.
Well, no, and you look at like on the thing with the Klamath, with the states of California and Oregon becoming co-licensees with a phony shell corporation that has no assets to do a project that's never been done before in the whole world, that somebody really familiar with the industry of surety and bonds said they would require a $7 billion bond to do the project. Oh, wait, do they have a bond? No, they don't, because no one in their right mind would ever write it. So the states became the co-licensees, and every single person who has a wallet in the state of California and the state of Oregon is on the hook for this. And then, well, you live in Montana, so you're probably thinking, thank God I don't live there. Those guys are idiots. But, you know, right now, with the disaster in the making and 50 million cubic yards of sediment that isn't planning on being removed, they think it's somehow going to magically go to the ocean. And even if it did, it sounds like a big clog to me. But so if that goes to a Superfund situation, federal government back involved, your wallet's now on the hook. So the decisions that these bureaucrats are making to say that, you know, it's interesting. We're actually talking around it, but the concept of technocracy, and I know you know all of that because you know Patrick Wood, but Patrick Wood wrote an incredible book called Technocracy Rising, and I have that linked on the website. If you're driving, don't write it down. Just look on the site under things we recommend. But technocracy is the concept of having the, quote, experts run everything. So this would be basically the bureaucracy, the executive branch bureaucracy, be in charge of everything. All those dummies electing other dummies, well, they're just messing everything up. We should let the experts run it. And the funny part is, it's like, well, it's not funny. It's like funny illuminating bad. We did that during COVID. How'd that work out?
I mean, well, and we're doing it through the agencies right now on all these things we're discussing. And that's been the big fight for the last century, is that very thing. Another quote from Hayek, he said, it would scarcely be an exaggeration to say that the greatest danger to liberty today comes from the men who are most needed and most powerful in modern government, namely the efficient expert administrators exclusively concerned with what they regard as the public good. And then he says, though theorists may still talk about the democratic control of these activities, all who have direct experience in this matter agree that, as one English writer put it, if the minister's control has become a myth, the control of Parliament is and always has been the merest fairy tale. And what he's saying there, that's an Englishman saying that. But in the American context, if the president can't even hardly control the administrative bureaucracy and the agencies, the idea that Congress pulling them in and trying to give some accountability and provide democratic accountability is a fairy tale. If it's to the converse, it's a myth for the president or the minister. So these expert administrators have now been able to wield a very powerful, well-funded administrative state that's been established over the years in our country. And I would say that they've deviated in many cases from what Congress prioritized in the cornerstone statutes that our lands and resources are supposed to be governed by.
Yeah, and deviated from what the public, I think, would have given. You know, the public would have supported the mission that as it started, but that isn't necessarily what we're doing now. We have to take a really quick break. We're on a 30-minute break this hour. Things are just getting switched up. So, I don't know. Live the dream, huh? So we got to go for almost 25 minutes. Pretty great. We'll be back with our guest, Nathan Deshmaker. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at We the People Radio.
U.S.
Well, they say the sea is rising. Well, that's all right with me. 'Cause there ain't no other place than on the sea I'd rather be. And that second coming's coming. It's right around the bend. And someday could be any day, and this world is gonna end. But that's alright, that's okay. There ain't nothing we can do about the whole thing anyway. It's a hang-on kind of ride. We're spinning through space and time, rocking this big old rock, just trying to have some fun. So let's drink another beer. Here's to another year, let's take another crazy trip around the sun. A sweet old lady was 84 when her kin folks came for a month or more. Now from overwork she's on the other shore. Much too late was y'all come back, and it says in the farmer's almanac, it says, visitors and fish smell after 3 days. Our leader was a silver-tongued man. He deceived the people of the land. And when he got caught, he couldn't stand. It's a little offbeat and a little off track, but it says in the farmer's almanac, it says, in rivers and bad government, the lightest things float to the top. Deedle-dee-doo, deedle-doo-doo-doo, deedle-dee-doo.
Well, you know what? If Johnny Cash said it, it must be true.
I'd like to go back and touch on something you mentioned earlier, Nathan, was the situation in California. People are leaving California in mass. Fortunately, it's the people that can afford to move are moving. They're getting out of the state. And so what we're left with are a lot of hardworking people who are, you know, they work every day and try to keep their head above water, and a growing number of people that are dependent on state and federal handouts to afford to live here. That ratio is changing, and I think the more people we get on the handout side, puts us in a really precarious situation when, what you said, the government cuts back on those handouts, and now you've got a major part of your population that is going to be hit very, very hard with a lot of this stuff that's going on right now. Right now, they're not having to pay for it. I mean, I go to the grocery store. I see the people with two carts full of groceries that are paying with an EBT card. You take that away, or you cut back on that, and that's when you're going to see things change. It's not going to change as long as you keep, handing people free stuff. Why would they vote to make any changes in that system? Because it's free.
Exactly. Well, and Frederick Bossy, I think, said that everyone is currently living under the illusion that we can enrich ourselves at the expense of everybody else.
Right.
And the late Justice Scalia said in his work, he commented on this and said, "I know no society today or in any era of history in which high degrees of intellectual and political freedom have flourished side by side with a high degree of state control over the relevant citizens' economic life. The free market, which presupposes relatively broad economic freedom, has historically been the cradle of broad political freedom, and in modern times, the demise of economic freedom has been the grave of political freedom as well. As a practical matter, he who controls my economic destiny controls much more of my life as well." And that's what's so dangerous about central economic systems and socialist state frameworks is it centralizes things and creates dependencies. So what ends up happening, not by a centralizing economic process and ripping away alternatives available to the consumer and creating that dependency, you're also consolidating political power by creating those dependencies. Mm-hmm. And that's how communist regimes have always worked and whittled away at free societies. And that's the sad thing is because we've been functioning under propaganda that rehashes out and claims socialism and communism can actually result in beneficial contexts. For some reason, enough people and the people in a lot of positions of power have bought back and reasserted those things. And it boils down, like you said, your example, to the individual level. And so the question is, how do we, it's not an easy answer to the question, but how do we, as a people, turn the tide and start going in a direction that, because, I mean, it's called the Declaration of, it's not the Declaration of Dependence, it's the Declaration of Independence, and all men are the dignity of the individual is protected under law, and we find these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal with certain unalienable rights given among men, life, liberty, and property, and then governments are instituted to preserve those rights. That's a negative function of government to provide, like an umpire in a ball game, to make sure the rules of fair play are being followed by those participating, and so that they can prosper. We should seek, even the Bible says that it's a basic biblical principle, we should seek another man's wealth and not our own. You know, there's a sense in which we should. So when government and people are creating frameworks of dependency, that's not loving and serving your fellow man and neighbor. We need to help them stand on their own two feet and be independent to the degree they're able to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the kicker. I don't know, the interesting effect that it has. Some people will always fight. You know, it's just kind of how they're wired. And then we have another percentage that'll just roll over because it doesn't matter. The Eeyores of the world, you know. We can't win. It doesn't matter. Don't bother.
Vote doesn't count.
And vote doesn't count. Might as well just let them do it. But there are a whole lot of other people that are trying to figure out, you know, which team to be on. They don't want to waste their time. Maybe it's better to be Eeyore and just pretend it's not happening.
Well, I think more people are starting to realize that this system is kind of coming apart at the seams. I mean, you know, we used to have fast food restaurants where you could go in and grab a hamburger and hit the road, and it was fairly inexpensive.
Yeah.
Those places, yeah, there's... You hear every day of these restaurants closing, these fast food restaurants closing, because they're losing their base. People that are having a hard time making the dollar stretch aren't going there anymore because they can't afford $20 for a hamburger, French fries, and a Coke. That's crazy. And so they're not going there. And so... these small businesses are realizing, oh, well, I'm going to put a kiosk in, and that'll cut my cost. Well, it might cut your cost, but it's not lowering the price of the product. And as that product continues to be high and unreachable for more and more people, more and more businesses are going to go broke. And I think there's going to be a lot of people say, hey, something has to change. Our leadership is failing us, allowing this to happen. But the first thing I think we need to do is get off the federal and state doles. I mean, I had a city official tell me one time, the only reason we have a recycle program in our town is because we get federal money for it. We don't make any money with that. We employ some people, and we, as long as we generate X amount of recyclables that don't go back into our landfills, we get federal money for that. And who does that really benefit? Nobody. It's just free money that our state and city governments get from the federal government. And federal government coming in and putting all this money into states, pretty soon the state gets to a point where, hey, we can't do that or we'll lose our funding. Well, maybe we need to lose our funding to get back on track, because it's polluting the system is what's happening.
Well, the problem is when you inject a substantial amount of federal dollars into local budgets, it's very difficult to remove those dollars.
Oh, yeah.
Because now it's not just you've cost-shared your budget on items, but like you said, you're employing people now. So you may get into this two-year grant to employ this young person to administer this grant for the community, or to do this or to do that or whatever it may be. And it may be on conditions that aren't fully agreeable, but it's not that bad, so we'll sign up for the money, because there's always language attached to the money. And, you know, that's happening out here in rural America, in Montana. You know, you have people signing up for NFWF, National Fish and Wildlife Business Plan and Grant Program. And in the business plan, it labels transmission lines, outbuildings, basically human development as predator habitat, and one of the top things on the list that needs to be mitigated. And I've made that case. It's like, why are we signing up for dollars that are funneled through a program that has a bunch of special interest NGOs and government actors implementing it, and we endorse it at the local conservation district level? And it's painting our constituency of people that actually live on the land out here as what needs mitigated.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the problem is you buy into the grant program, and then you hire people to administer whatever it is, even if the project's agreeable, like building some fence or putting in a water system or something. The problem is the grant runs out in a couple of years.
Right.
And if you want to keep... you've already put newsletters out saying, look, we employed people in the community. So if you want to maintain that employment and that message of, look what good we're doing by creating employment, et cetera, you're bound to the next grant cycle. So then they can increase the language that's disagreeable to you. And then, you know, well, they change it a little bit. It's still not too bad. So we can work with that. And besides, we're hiring people, and, you know, that's a good thing, so we want to create that employment for our community. But the point is, that trajectory, it's compromise leads to more compromise, and when you create fiscal dependence on it, then the problem is, if you get to the point to where it's so disagreeable you can't do it anymore, and you're saying, I won't do that, then you've created this whole synthetic local economic activity in your local community that now is unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
That you can't even pay those positions to do those things anymore, because it was all being funded and subsidized through grants to begin with. And if the grants, the people who write the grants, becomes disagreeable, you lose. So what happens, these groups that go on that business trajectory, and a lot of our local communities are doing that, is you create those dependencies, and you have a choice between keeping these jobs and these people we've employed or rejecting the program.
Yeah. Well, you know, you see it in all sorts of stuff, not just, you know, the things that we're discussing, but one of the examples that comes to mind is the jail. I know up in Siskiyou County, and I'm sure it happened in other counties in California, they could get grant money for a jail from the state, but the, you know, by the time you did all the math and everything, and then you needed more employees to run it, well, that's real nice, but they didn't have them, and that workforce is pretty diminished. So they had no way to run the jail once it got started. You had a matching funds problem, and then you had an upkeep situation once that money ran out. So it kind of walks them into things that unless they really, really game it out, it's not workable long term. But the citizenry attacked the counties that turned back the jail money because they needed jail, you know, they needed more jail space. And people were like, well, you didn't take the jail money. And I don't think people realize there's a little more to it than that. You know, the money doesn't just come forever.
Well, it always runs out. And then like
OPM, remember? Other people's money.
That's right. It always runs out. And when it does, now you're stuck with how do I maintain it? Just like what you said, Nathan.
Yeah. We see it all over
the
place.
Well, historically, like welfare, hospitals, providing for the poor, all those things were provided largely through non-regulated Christian charities for the first 150-plus years of the country. Charles Finney's benevolent empire in the 1800s had a budget that rivaled the federal government's budget at the time, and it provided a huge amount of services for orphans, for the poor, because the Bible says that too. The poor you always have with you. You know, this utopian idea we are just going to be able to someday create some kind of maximum efficiency and eradicate the poor off the earth, there's always going to be the issue. The question is how we respond to it, and government has never been a successful helper of the less fortunate among us. It comes from Christian charity. And through Christian charity, you also have accountability. If you have a brother that's going on a bad path and you're trying to support him and help him financially and everything else, if you give him $50 for gas or, you know, $200 for rent or whatever, and he goes and buys a 30 rack and sits in the casino, you can immediately cut that fund off immediately. Well, you're not. So there's that immediate accountability of individual charity that takes place in society. But you need a virtuous and a moral people that actually adhere to what our founders did, the Christian ethics that were the foundation for free governments. And now we've allowed the state to assume and delegated illegitimately to the state to assume the responsibilities we each individually and corporately should be assuming for ourselves.
Well, and if you look at the border situation, I mean,
the
Christian charities have always been heavily involved in supporting people that, you know, come across, can't afford it, you know, and they give them housing, they give them food. But because of the actions of the federal government, they have put so much stress on that system, they can't do it anymore. So they go to their churches, they go to their communities and say, hey, we need more money, we have to support these people, and they can't. They can't do it. They don't have the money anymore, and that is a direct result of poor governance.
It is, and it can. The danger is you have to actually open the avenue for utilizing what otherwise is considered a Christian charity for things that are actually not good, like human trafficking and other things. There's things I think taking place. I mean, you have all these process people coming just all over the place. It's an absolute mess, and it's a breakdown of the one thing that the federal government has the enumerated power in the Constitution to do is protect the states from invasion. So
that's obviously not working out.
Not doing it.
Not doing that. And a lot of the NGOs are getting, they're not working on private funds. A lot of them are working on government money.
Well, there's exactly what happens is even the churches have done the same thing a lot in the West is they're cost sharing. The churches are starting to function like our local governments are functioning and cost sharing these different grant programs, especially all this social justice stuff, I'm sure. And obviously there's good churches out there and Christian folks that don't sign up those programs because it's too much of an obvious compromise. But, But with that said, it's...
See, we starve stuff out. That's the trick. See, we make it really hard for people to earn a living. We make it difficult for people to maintain their world. You know, look at who would think when you drive through the flyover states or the places that would qualify for that. People drive along and they look, off the freeway or whatever, and they think, well, who lives out here? What do these people do? And when you make it impossible for those people to survive and just your rank and file Americans to survive, and it all gets funneled back into the government cheese program, the whole deal, the wheels come off, because then people are afraid to hold it accountable. Gee, you know, what if my government cheese goes away? You know, that's not good. I better keep my mouth shut. They're employing me. They're feeding me. They're...
Yeah, exactly. That's where... See, and I think that's happening in the federal agencies. I think there's a lot of still well-intentioned and qualified professional people within local field offices in the Forest Service and BLM that don't necessarily agree with a whole bunch of stuff that they're having to process.
Oh, yeah. We had a
Forest Supervisor. But they can't, if they speak out against it...
Yep.
They're placed. They're either replaced or who knows what happens.
We have,
so yeah, there's
one who got sent to Siberia.
That's the dangers of a salaried bureaucracy.
True story. And we had a Forest Supervisor here. Yeah, same exact same thing. She did what needed to be done when they were feeding them moldy food on the fire lines, and she is now doing research in Riverside. So. Apparently Siberia is Riverside now.
Yeah.
Good
so
for me.
She got sent off to Riverside. But, yeah, there is no – you have a lot of people who would like to speak up who have a lot of they have a lot of experience and expertise, but they'll just flat tell you, you know, I'm 2 years from retirement or I'm 3 years from retirement. I can't do it. And
– Well, exactly. Well, there's that.
You're exactly right.
You know, what I will say, though, is – what I've seen in a couple cases, when local governments step up to the plate and they put strong, substantive comments into the record on these things moving through the agencies, some of those people at those local offices that those documents come across their desk are relieved by it, because it's a way that, even though they're too cowardly to say anything, they don't want to lose their job or whatever, but it's a way when local governments come to the table and start asking key questions and bringing the law forward, I think some of the local people in those local settings, and I know that because I know officials who have engaged in process, and then those local field office people are saying, hey, here's a rule on this or that. You guys have this time frame to comment on. So they reach out and even ask. When you put input in that's very strong and makes a case in the record, there's people internally, I think, that see that and are like, man, about time, there's something being done here. But like you said, they have to be careful how they go about dealing with that. So.
Yeah, and you know, the other piece of this, Congress exists outside of FOIA. So when they speak to their congressional offices, members of Congress or their staff, that is not discoverable through FOIA. So there is absolute anonymity available to them. Of course, I wouldn't go talk to Adam Schiff's staff or maybe, you know, Barbara Lee or, okay, I got a long list. All those folks, I don't know that
That's a really good point.
I wouldn't put my career in their hands, but do a little homework, ask around, you know, who can I talk to that'll keep it quiet? And don't, you know, the whistleblower thing, we've interviewed lots of them and all that, but you don't have to necessarily be a whistleblower to make a difference. Whistleblower kind of means if you're going to bring documents forward, you have to do that. Otherwise, you're breaking the law. But if information is really all that's required, tell your member of Congress and or their staff what they should be looking at, what they should be asking for, because you know the inner workings. You know, you federal personnel guy, you come forward and say, hey, you know what, you ought to ask them about this, or this. They can go do that, and they're not required to tell the agency who gave them that bright idea. So that's something that I encourage people to encourage the good people in the federal agencies to go and make use of that. It's a good tool. We wrecked the show.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
I ruined the show. Okay, so in our last couple of minutes, I know there's like a whole lot of other stuff we're going to cover when your friend Bill comes on. But we'll each have a friend, Bill. What would you encourage people to keep track of now, besides reading these two articles? Because I really do think the farm article is amazing, as is the other one.
Yeah. Well, I'll send a couple other things over to you that you could post on there, a couple links as well, if that's a possibility.
Yes, absolutely.
Because the nice thing is there is some recent publications, the Buckeye Institute Economic Department with their release, and you got the CO2 Coalition and what was brought forward in Wyoming. You have the 12 state agricultural commissioners issuing a letter to these six big banks January of this year. There's a lot of bad moving, but it's encouraging seeing that there's others in leadership stepping up. And George Orwell said, when in times of deceit, telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act.
Hmm.
And
we're there.
So it takes courage, takes boldness. Yeah. So I'm encouraged. That's what I'll leave the audience is. One, look back to our forefathers and the great cloud of witnesses that went before us and stood and fought the good fight, and follow their example. And two, look around to and be thankful and pray for the men and women that are in positions of authority in our magistrates that are bringing the truth forward, because it's never majorities that change the course of history in the world. It's a dedicated, disciplined minority of people that scorn the values of this world and live by rigid discipline and have their mind and heart set on the right things. So we need to support one another in that and be professional. Don't get down to the level of the opposition throw names around. Be professional if you can and do your homework.
That's exactly it. Nathan, we got to leave it right there. Thank you so much for being on.
Sounds good.
You can find the archive of this later at wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a man a free house and he'll bust out the windows, put his family on food stamps. Now he's a big spender, no food on the table, and the bills ain't paid, 'cause he's spending on cigarettes and PGA. They'll turn us all into beggars 'cause they're easier to bleed.